Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case that will be argued. I understand that both sides are here and they are ready. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Basil. To my left is Justice Wallach, and I'm Chief Justice Sutterth. Before the attorneys begin their argument, would the clerk please call the case? Thank you. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May I please support the council? My name is Jeffrey Shearer, and I represent Mr. Martinez for this appeal.
In our brief, I guess there's two things at the outset I'd like to note for the court. And obviously, I can go into the issues the court prefers, if there's any the court prefers. I was going to focus on issues 1 and 3. Which are the issues of identity and legal sufficiency for identity and causation. That's issue 1. And issue 3 is the question regarding whether or not Michael Morton was complied with and properly preserved. Issue 2, we're not abandoning. We're just not going to use our time here today unless the court wants to dive into it about the lesser included offense instruction. And so on that note, I guess a slight rephrasing of issue 1 may be in order because there's a lot of stuff to unpack in this case. The issue of in-court identity is kind of an old school one, for lack of a better phrase. You know, many years ago when our country was founded, you know, we didn't have videotape evidence or anything like that. In-court ID was perhaps a bigger deal than it is today, but it's still an important aspect of the sufficiency analysis. And so I cited, I think, 3 cases in my brief. And one of them, I didn't note this in the brief, I don't believe, so I'll note it now. The Farnan case, I believe it was, is an unpublished case. I don't think I made that clear in my brief, but I maintain candor with the court. And so all the cases I cite, there are additional witnesses who identify the person accused and on trial. Whereas here, or corroborating evidence through videotape or something else, such as admissions of counsel, that type of thing. Whereas here, we have a single witness. And so a reframing of the issue, perhaps, is the legal sufficiency analysis, the due process safeguard that it's supposed to be, where we ask a court to examine if a rational jury should have or could have convicted someone, is due process there complied with when a single complaining witness who is impeached with a conviction for truthfulness and who is purported to be intoxicated at the time of their accusation, and when we have roughly 12 hours of uncorroborated time, is a conviction based upon that without a clear in-court identification of who caused their alleged injuries, can a conviction on that be sustained? And it's our position that it cannot.
But your position really is that there could be confusion between the son and the father because they shared the same name, right? That's the essence of your complaint, right?
That is one portion, Your Honor, of our complaint.
Okay.
We believe there's some ambiguities there. And typically,
was there any evidence that the father was culpable in any manner?
I don't think there's anything in the record that they clearly identified the father as opposed to my client.
Was the father ever referenced by name at trial?
Well, there's several references to Mr. Martinez, if that's what you mean. There's ambiguities.
Okay, but he's never referenced as Ricky Don Martinez Sr.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Unless it's
or
maybe
Ricky Don Martinez or Ricky Martinez.
Well, there's There's ambiguous references to Ricky Martinez.
So what you're saying is that when a witness testifies as to Ricky Martinez, they could be testifying as to the father?
I'm saying from the record, it's unclear.
Okay.
And I would say normally, it's for the jury to resolve ambiguities. We're not saying that the court should step into the province of the jury to resolve conflicts, because the case law is clear the court's not supposed to do that. We're saying that from this record, when you have one witness under these facts, we don't think a rational juror could have found that appellant is the one who caused these injuries.
Well, couldn't a trial counsel have, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Couldn't trial counsel have clarified the ambiguity if they had perceived there was ambiguity at trial?
Well, I do think we tried to do that. And through our cross-examination, I think that the court did not ask this, but I think that the question of whether or not an objection should have been made to the lack of ID. The case that talks about in-court ID is from 1981, I believe, and that's the Rolfing case that I believe is a seminal case on that. And I think it was in 2001 where Texas jurisprudence said you no longer need to preserve error under legal sufficiency. And so under that kind of guise, if you will, the question is, if I'm going to point out that the state didn't properly identify my client on trial, I just did the state's job for them. They're going to say, oh, well, thanks for correcting that. Let's go fix that real quick. We're going to put so-and-so back on the stand, and then we're going to thank you for helping us prove our case. And so I think...
Wasn't Mr. Martinez identified as the defendant throughout the trial? Or let's not say throughout the trial, at various points during the trial.
There were portions of the trial where I think the court addressed him as Mr. Martinez or defendant.
And the complaining witness identified him as the defendant.
Well, she has a clear language issue, which we point out.
But why is that not the jury's domain to sort out as to whether or not her testimony is credible with respect to whether or not she's properly identifying the defendant?
Well, I think that's a reasonable question. And I think under these facts, I would say it's that no rational juror could have believed her testimony, because she was impeached for lying to the police with a conviction out of the same court. And the state didn't give us a copy of that with our discovery. We found it on our own.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. But again, why isn't that in the jury's province as to whether or not she's been sufficiently impeached that they don't believe her when she said that defendant is the one that did this to me?
So I guess I have kind of a lengthy answer, Your Honor, if I may.
Go ahead.
I did not say this in my brief, but, you know, we don't allow convictions on the basis of an informant's testimony by themselves or an accomplice's testimony by themselves, because they're not necessarily reliable. And so here, I think we have a reliability question. If she's intoxicated at the time of the offense, alleged, doesn't have a good grasp of the English language, which she says on the stand on pages 130 and 133 of the record, and we have large gaps of unaccounted for time, where if someone's intoxicated, they may not remember things real well.
But is that our province to decide, or is it the jury's province to decide?
Well, I believe, and I'm asking this court, you know, does it satisfy due process under those facts? Because I don't think it does. It doesn't sit well when I think of what our founders wanted our court system to be. If the law on accomplice and informants.
But she's not an accomplice or an informant. She's simply impeached.
Yes, ma'am. That is correct. But
doesn't impeachment amount to a credibility issue? And if it's a credibility issue, it goes to the jury?
I think it goes to a credibility and reliability issue. Because the only question that was asked, and it was asked twice, is he in the courtroom? Yes.
Was the father in the courtroom?
I don't recall.
Does the record reflect that the father was in the courtroom?
It does not. Not that I know of. But all these other cases, they identify the accused through clothing or personal appearance, or there's a video, or there's additional witnesses and documentation, or an admission that that person is who was accused of the crime. That the person who is accused is in fact the one who committed the crime alleged. We don't have any of that here. We just have one person who is not truthful and who may have had severe perception issues at the time. It doesn't sit well, and that's analogous to an accomplice or an informant who may have their own perceptions or biases, and we don't sustain convictions on those. And so that's kind of our, I don't know if I answered the question
Well, let me ask you about your 39.14 argument. What did the state not do in this case that it should have done?
I believe they should have given us copies of the prior convictions alleged.
Of their own initiative, they should have handed you copies.
Bill, they could have emailed them or provided them digitally. And we asked for them.
And on the basis of what language in 39.14 are you saying they have the obligation to provide you with the copies?
I think it's under the produce language. And in Watkins, I believe the court...
But it doesn't say produce. It says produce and permit the inspection and the electronic duplication, copying, and photographing by or on behalf of the defendant. So where's the obligation for them to just hand it to you?
Well, that's a great question. I think that it comes under the terms of the courts trying to avoid the red tape and bureaucracy associated with previous discovery battles that are discussed at length in Watkins.
I agree with you. But where's the language in the statute that says they have the unilateral obligation to give you a copy of the document?
I think that if we're asking for defense counsel to continuously go to a prosecutor's office as a practical matter to inspect the file, I don't think that answers the mail under the Michael Morton Act, because that could be argued as a document dump where things in the file are just in there, hundreds, thousands of pages potentially, and we're just supposed to mine through it without a clear indicator of what it is that's in the file and where it's at. And some people take cases on where they might be an hour or two away, which is myself and co-counsel at trial. Our offices are not co-located in Wise County.
Great policy argument, but why is the obligation created under the words of the statute where it says, and permit the inspection, the language I just quoted?
I would say that I understand the court is reading it from a produce and allow for inspection point of view. I think that if we were to inspect the originals, we can do that with an open file policy. But if they're going to comply with the produce element, it's our contention that produce means a easily accessible copy of the item, and things like video and stuff like that.
Are you changing your argument? You're saying an easily accessible copy of the document. Does that mean they don't have the obligation to forward a copy to you?
I think that they do, and in practice, that's what they do in Wise County. They will forward you all the documents, and if there is a video, they will mail it to you. That's the practice in Wise County. And so along with the standards and practices of the county might dictate, but based on the norms there, that is what we expected. And I think under the local rules as well, which there seems to be four different versions of that we talk about, and I think out of fairness to the state, they were probably confused as to which one was the accurate local rules. And I would say now that I'm confused as well, because there's four different versions, and I have copies of some of them.
Well, that may make three of us.
I'm sorry?
Nothing. Go ahead.
But I think the Watkins court spelled it out that punishment evidence, the exhibits themselves, should be disclosed properly, and notice isn't adequate for that. you know, if I'm relying on a notice provision, I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe they're going to use that for like impeachment or something, but they don't necessarily intend to use it unless we open the door or the client testifies.
But they sent a 404B notice
they
in
did.
This case.
They did. And I believe they did in Watkins as well.
I agree.
And to me, that's not adequate for compliance with Michael Morton.
But it certainly might implicate the question of harm.
Well, and I believe in Watkins, they reversed for a harm analysis, and I believe no harm was found. But a question I might dive into and rebuttal, I'm running out of time. You know, if Michael Morton's supposed to be this due process safeguard, is a higher analysis than, if it's supposed to provide greater protections than due process, then is a higher analysis than the typical statutory one in order? Because what does it mean then?
So you're saying we should abandon the harm analysis?
I'm not. I'm just putting the question out there, and I'm out of time. If it's supposed to provide greater protections, what is the proper analysis for it?
And hasn't the Court of Criminal Appeals told us we do a harm analysis in Michael Morton cases?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Hasn't the Court of Criminal Appeals told us we do a harm analysis in Michael Morton situations?
I believe that's exactly what they did. And I can continue to, or I can dive into it.
We'll save it for rebuttal.
Yes, Thank ma'am.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Thank you for your time and your attention to this issue that we have before us today. My name is Robert Carper. I'm the Assistant County Attorney, and this is Che Roturnbull. He's the County Attorney for Wise County. Okay. I was prepared to argue issue number two, but I may spend a little bit of time on it. I don't think it, you know, I didn't prepare or anticipate that it would take very long anyway, but and I think I might jump to the chase on issue number one and maybe answer some of your questions. Okay. I had something prepared, but you obviously asked some questions that I think I can answer on that. Okay. And I think your question was there any ambiguity between junior and senior? Okay. And despite what appellant says, there was another witness that testified in this case, and that was Ricky Don Martinez Jr.'s mother, who identified him by name as Ricky Don Martinez Jr. and as her son. And so there can be no ambiguity with the jury that maybe this was the father, because she identified him as her son. Okay. She was also a witness because she largely corroborated almost the entire testimony of the victim in this case. She identified her as being at her home, at what time they, all of the facts pretty much lined up as far as what time she arrived, what the activities were, and all of that. Obviously, she was not a direct witness to the assault that occurred and the unlawful restraint that occurred, but she did witness, or she did testify to the fact that anybody leaving his room would have to go through her room, and her testimony was that she had to escape out the window, and the mother's testimony was that she never saw her leave through her room. So that corroborates the fact that, well, yeah, she did leave through the window and didn't leave out the room, out of the room. Okay. Legal sufficiency for the evidence, they're obviously contesting that, and specifically the identification of the accused, Mr. Ricky Don Martinez Jr. Now, I don't, you know, y'all are well aware of the standard on legal sufficiency challenges, and we obviously don't want to have you replace what the jury was able to view in person. And you know, we have obviously written down what they testified to, what was on the record, but obviously a jury can read body language and how it's said and things like that and assign credibility and weight to that. Okay. And so we don't have this panel sitting in as, it's usually the 13th juror, but in this case it would be the 7th juror, and try to make a decision based upon that. Now, in regards to identification, I think I put it in my brief, and I put each and every place in which he was identified both by name and interchangeably as the defendant. He was identified during voir dire by both the trial court and the state to the jurors both as Ricky Don Martinez Jr. and the defendant. Okay, he was identified by the court and the state through reading of the complaint and the court taking his plea on each of those complaints. The court asked, would the defendant please rise? And Ricky Don Martinez Jr. rose when the court asked him to. He asked, how does the defendant plead to count number one? And he said, not guilty. He asked, how do you plead, Mr. Martinez, to count number two? And he said, not guilty. And these are all done in front of the juror. And so each and every one of these witnesses referred to him by name, Ricky Don Martinez Jr. They referred to him also as the defendant. At no time during this entire process did appellant object to that, to either his full name being used or using defendant in referring to Ricky Don Martinez Jr., the defendant in this case. Now, I just wanted to briefly go over even the, and so the name and defendant was used interchangeably through opening statements, through the case in chief, through the defense's case, and through closing arguments. They were used in all of those. And at no time during the pendency of this, it was only after the state rested that he then made his motion for a directed verdict based upon a insufficient identification. And the victim in this case identified him both by name at the beginning of her testimony, and then at the end of her testimony, she testified that the defendant was the one that caused her injuries, and the defendant was the one that unlawfully restrained her. Now, in regards to, he has several different cases, and I believe each one of the cases that he used actually supports our position as far as there's no set statutory or case law as far as what process has to be used or what things you have to establish to make an in-court identification. And even one of the cases that he used, it seems to indicate that an in-court identification was not even done, and that's, I believe, the Perkey case. Yeah, the Perkey case, a 1983 case out of the Court of Appeals out of Beaumont, and it basically says, despite a lack of an in-court identification. And so in that case, it sounds like it didn't even make an in-court identification in that case. But on his Rolfing case, that's a Court of Criminal Appeals case, they found that appellant was on trial and no other. In this case, on the appellant readily admitted that Ricky Don Martinez was the only one on trial and no other person was in the courtroom that was on trial. Okay. In the Rolfing case, they also found that no objection was made to appellant being employed identification procedure throughout the trial. So this was our way we employed identification, was referring to him as Ricky Don Martinez Jr. and as the defendant interchangeably, and that was never objected to. In the Perkey case, that was the one where they say despite a lack of in-court identification, they consider all the times that appellant was introduced to the jury by name and as a defendant used interchangeably throughout the trial, and then based upon the totality of circumstances, there could be no doubt in any of the jurors' minds as to whom the witness was referring to when they referred to them as the defendant. The Perkey case also went on to identify the trial court identified appellant by name on multiple occasions, which is what we had in this case as well. And witness referred to accused by the same name. Okay, so he was always referred to either as Ricky Don Martinez Jr. or as the defendant. And then appellant never disagreed with references to him by his name. Okay. In the Farnan case, which he referenced, which is a 2006 Court of Appeals out of El Paso, they found four reasons, and we had three reasons included in ours as far as identification. They said complaint listed appellant's full name. Ours did. Both complaints did. Witness referred to appellant by his full name and as the defendant. All of our witnesses referred to him by his full name and as a defendant. And then they had a toxicology report identified appellant as the subject of this test, which in conjunction ours, we had a Decatur police officer that came in and testified as to defendant's name, and that she had printed off a picture of the defendant when she was provided that name, and the victim corroborated or stated that that was the individual that had committed these crimes against her. So even with all of the appellant's cases, we had everything that all those cases had in it as far as satisfying a identification. Okay. May have any questions? I was going to move on to the next issue. Okay. Issue number two, I'll just touch on that very briefly as far as appellant's request for a lesser included instruction. I think this case, this court has squarely or definitively defined what is and what is not a lesser included, and specifically to the exact same facts as we have in this case. In the Welsh case, which I briefed in my reply brief in 2009, you had that same question asked, is contact assault, is that lesser included of bodily injury assault? And this court came down and said, no, they have different elements contained in the lesser that's in the greater, and so as a result, it's not a lesser included. Now, the Court of Criminal Appeals took that up for review, and I believe they took that up for review. That's why it's under the McKithen. And I believe they took that up because you can have a black and white comparison, letter for letter comparison of the elements of the two offenses. And before that, if you didn't have the same, then one was not considered a lesser of the other. But they wanted, I believe, to take a more liberal review of that and apply what fundamentally the concept, fundamentally equivalent concept, which is kind of more of a gray area, is, well, maybe they're not letter for letter the same, but maybe if one really means the other, then we could apply that. But even after applying that, they still upheld the decision by this court in Welsh that contact assault is not a lesser included of bodily injury assault. All right, issue number three, and I would like to start off by just saying that I've been working in the Wise County Attorney's Office for, it'll be 15 years next March. And the entire time I've been here, I don't know if you're familiar with the DA's, James Staton, that's who I've been mostly under. And even from the time I started there, we always had an open file policy. And we take pride in the fact that we try to work our best with every attorney and try to accommodate them as best we can with anything that they may need, anything that they may desire, okay? And typically our process is, once you file your discovery request, then we give you everything that we have presently in that file, whether it be pictures, videos, reports, statements, anything like that, and you know, however you want it. If you want it digitally, if you want us to send you paper copies, or if you want to come up and pick up paper copies, anything like that, however you want it. And we've had that policy the entire time, even before Michael Morton was passed. That was our policy. So that really didn't change anything for us because we already were completely transparent, didn't hide anything. Whatever you wanted, we'll make copies for you. Whatever you need, we'll bend over backwards to get that done. And typically, if you come in, it's done in 5 minutes. We don't make you wait. You don't have to file anything. And I believe in this case, we did not have the documents in question as far as the prior convictions. We did not have those presently in the file whenever the original discovery was requested, okay? We got those after the fact. And as you pointed out, I referenced our 404B notices. We sent not only one, but two of them. We sent one in April, and we sent another one in October. And I specifically just referenced that to show that we let the other side defense know that these documents, you know, these are what we found in his criminal history, and these are the documents that we were prepared to use at trial if, in fact, we did go to trial. And so...
But in Watkins, didn't they send a 404B notice also?
I'm not sure if they did or not, but I can distinguish our case from Watkins because Watkins specifically said that the state withheld, would not let them examine those documents. We never denied access to those documents, to examine those documents, and Watkins doesn't say anything about whether or not they requested a copy or whether they were denied a copy, but you can kind of maybe presume that they did, because if they're not going to give them access to it, then they're probably not going to make copies for them either. So we can probably presume if they did ask for them, they denied them that as well. But we never denied them access to examine it, and then no request was ever made to us as far as making copies for them.
But did you say we have these documents in any other way than through your 404B notice?
Can you repeat that, please?
Did you say we have these documents, we're going to use these documents in any other way than through your 404B notice?
That was, as far as I know, that's the only notice. We sent them twice, that notice that these are out there and that we have.
There's a statement on page 34 of your brief that says the state produced and made available evidence in question on April 8th and 18th, 2022, but there's no record reference. So, I mean, that's what's confusing me, is whether the only thing you did was the 404B notice, or is there something else that's referenced by that sentence?
The 404B notice is the only notice that I'm aware of. Okay. And those, we sent out a notice on April 8th, and then we sent an additional notice on October 11th, I believe. Basically, we're the same things. Okay. And so, and like I put in my brief, you don't have to make an appointment. As long as our office is open, you can come in and review the file anytime you want. And
what about his theory that you had an affirmative obligation to send him the documents?
I don't read either the Michael Morton Act as that's the way that's worded, and our local rules basically match the Michael Morton Act as far as our local rules require us to disclose without being requested, disclose any prior convictions, which we did disclose those. And then it says the same language, make available those documents for examination and or copying. Okay. And so these, I don't have any information that they ever asked to look at the file or examine the file, but it was always available for the entire 10 months prior to trial for them to come in at any time, basically they wanted to, and review the file, look in the file, and if they needed a copy of that, it would have been done in about 5 minutes. Okay. But we have no evidence whatsoever that they ever requested us to provide them, or if they wanted to make a copy of it, or if they needed us to make a copy of it, we certainly would have, but we have no evidence that they ever requested any type of copy be made for them. And then I think what he attempts to do is try to say that produce equals, the appellant tries to say that produce somehow equals copy, but if that was the case, why does Michael Morton say both produce and copy? If produced equals copy, it would just say produced. And so it just basically says produce that, which we did. We went over to the clerk's office. We contacted the clerks that were out of county. We produced those documents, which we had them change them from the digital electronic form into an actual physical paper form, in which we took possession of and added it to the file, and then notified them that we, through our 404B and various other notices connected with that same document, that we had those in our possession and what our intent was to use those if it did in fact go to trial. And so my reading of that, produce does not equal copy. It means basically bring that document, in this case, into existence. And then, like I said, it was available to them for the entire 10 months prior to trial for them to examine and copy themselves, or if they needed us to, we would certainly have made a copy for them. Have any further questions? Pretty much sums up my. Okay.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Court.
So I think in response to some of the state's arguments about Michael Morton, and then I want to go back to the identity discussion, and perhaps I should have discussed this more in my brief, but I think local practices and norms are important here. If the local practice and norm is to email or mail items that are intended to be exhibits or part of discovery, then the expectation is that that's how something you intend to produce, whether it's punishment evidence or not, copies of a judgment, will be provided the same way. And if they don't, then the assumption, proper or not, is that, well, I guess they're not going to use those anymore. Or I can make an objection at trial for their exclusion, as the case in Heath allows.
But that's not an obligation imposed by the terms of the Michael Morton Act.
Well, I always think that a statute allows for local customs to fill in gaps. I don't think that's an inappropriate interpretation of any statute. Maybe that's what governs here. I don't know. But if, you know, courts have local rules as well, and the local, there's several different versions of those here, those don't answer the question either. But I can say that I do expect, when I practice in Wise County, for them to email or mail me copies of everything pertinent to the case. And so that was not done here. That's the norm. And so for them to say, well, we have a different standard, we gave our 404B, now you just need to come look at the file, that's weird. That was never clarified to us as appellant's counsel. That appears to be a different practice than what we've experienced there. So we're surprised.
So if you have one expectation, they have a different expectation, how are we supposed to decide whose expectation is correct?
Well, I think that the court can, so what I will say is, I think if the court were to ask the county attorney here, or the state's representatives here, is that the norm in Wise County, he would say yes. That is the norm. We mail or email those.
They just told us what the practice is in Wise County as they understand it. So wouldn't this have been something that should have been decided by the trial court if that's an issue? So that this court is not in a fact-finding position as to what the obligations are under the local rules.
Well, I think the definition of produce is such that the open file policies that offices used to have pre-Michael Morton does not answer the requirement that the legislator intended. And the court has asked me to point to a case that explicitly says that, and I guess I don't have one. Out of candor to the court. But I, to me, produce means provide. You need to provide it to me. And
is there any legal authority that supports that position?
I would say that it's implicit in Watkins that they need to provide it. And in Watkins, I believe it was about a 911 call that was found last minute, but it was in the state's possession. They themselves weren't necessarily aware of it, but the Watkins court said that doesn't matter. Or maybe that was Heath. Watkins was punishment evidence. Heath was the 911 call. I'm sorry.
What harm standard should we apply here for your Michael Morton violation claim?
Well, I think that the law is clear that right now the harmless error standard applies. But my question to the court may remain unanswered for a few years in jurisprudence. I don't know. If it's supposed to be a greater protection than due process, is there some other standard we can apply? And I honestly don't have the answer for that question. But back to the ID issue, I'm almost out of time. You know, all the Perkey, Farnan, Rolfing, and the other case I cite, all those had multiple other factors identifying the accused person. And here, you know, all we have are maybe some references to the name Martinez or Martinez Jr. by the court or counsel. And we have a single eyewitness who has some issues with the English language and potential intoxication.
But we have Mama saying she went in the room, she never came out. That hasn't
forced, I believe she it? Did say that.
Okay.
And I see that I'm out of time. I don't know if there's something I did not answer for the panel.
I think we're good.
Thank you all, or thank you for your time.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument. It's been helpful to us. Your case has now been submitted, and we are adjourned.